This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. This week, songwriter and author Alex Woodard joins us to talk about Ordinary Soil, a multi-generational saga of a Choctaw farming family in the Oklahoma Panhandle that traces the intertwined health of land, food, and people across more than a century. Then, we revisit my 2021 conversation with environmental journalist Carrie Gillam about her book, The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. It's about the groundbreaking case of school groundskeeper Lee Johnson, how he sued Monsanto, and won. Thanks. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This episode of Writer's Voice is sponsored by Larry's Coffee, exceptional coffee with a mission. Nearly all their beans are organic, fair trade, and shade grown, and their eco-friendly roasting reflects a deep commitment to sustainability. Larry's is also a certified B Corporation, showing how business can be a force for good. I've tried it. It's delicious. And every subscription through us supports Writer's Voice. Go to larryscoffee.com/voice. This episode of Writer's Voice is sponsored by Larry's Coffee, exceptional coffee with a mission. Nearly all their beans are organic, fair trade, and shade grown, and their eco-friendly roasting reflects a deep commitment to sustainability. Larry's is also a certified B Corporation, showing how business can be a force for good. I've tried it. It's delicious. And every subscription through us supports Writer's Voice. Go to larryscoffee.com/voice. It should be obvious to all of us that the health of our bodies begins with the health of the soil beneath our feet. Alex Woodard's Ordinary Soil follows six generations of a Choctaw farming family living on the same Oklahoma panhandle land from the late 19th century to the present. At its center is Jake, a struggling modern farmer whose physical and emotional health reflect the accumulated effects of generational trauma, environmental degradation, and the transformation of American agriculture. In our conversation, Woodard shares the novel's roots in both family history and contemporary concerns about industrial agriculture. The book contrasts indigenous farming traditions, particularly the Three Sisters method of planting corn, beans, and squash together, with the rise of chemical-intensive monoculture farming. Through the family story, Woodard explores how changes in the soil affect not only ecosystems, but human health as well. We also talk about glyphosate or Roundup, gut health, regenerative agriculture, and the growing scientific understanding of epigenetics. The novel suggests that both physical and emotional trauma can accumulate across generations, shaping the lives of descendants long after the original wounds occurred. At the same time, Woodard emphasizes that healing is possible for individuals, communities, and the land itself. Here's my conversation with Alex Woodard. Alex Woodard, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk about the book. Ordinary Soil covers multiple generations of a farming family, from a Choctaw warrior in 1898 to his, great-great-grandson, Jake, current day. And it moves back and forth between the early generations to the contemporary time. So orient us a bit to this family and their land. Tell us something about them.
Well, the idea here was I had a sort of a personal stake in it because my heritage on my maternal side is Choctaw, going a ways back. And it kind of all came together in this sort of serendipitous way, because I was thinking of writing this story about a family farming this same piece of land in the Oklahoma Panhandle from, you know, like you said, the Choctaw roots all the way through present day. But I didn't know that the people that were there, the indigenous people that wound up in the Panhandle, were the Choctaw. They were kind of the first on the Trail of Tears, which you may have heard of. It's associated with the Cherokee a lot, but it was actually the Choctaw that were the first to go. And they were kind of given whatever land nobody else wanted, right? And I think the typical acreage, I think it was 160 acres for a homestead. And so my idea was to have this patriarch of the family start farming that land however he could, in the ways that he had learned, and then follow the arc of the family all the way to present day. And by doing that, there was kind of a hidden agenda, right? My message underneath everything was the story of what's happened to the land and the food coming from the land and the people that are eating the food and working the land over, you know, the last 250 years and how that has really, or 150 years, how that's really affected human health and planetary health. But I wanted to do that. I wanted to kind of get that message out there in a story, in something that people would want to read and that they wouldn't even know that's the message they were getting till they're at the end and they say to themselves, there's something else going on here. So I was a little bit sneaky with it, but that was intentional. I really thought this story of chemical and mechanical agriculture and its evolution and what's happened to the land and the people as a result was an important one to tell.
Yes. And you open the book with the current farmer, Jake's attempt to commit suicide. And this is not something that's all that unusual among family farmers in the United States. In fact, there's a pretty high rate of suicide.
Yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, it's like, it's the highest rate. It still is. It's the highest rate of suicide in any American profession here in the States. So you would think it might be doctors or some other kind of like crazy high stress, high impact job, but it's actually farmers, which is fascinating to me.
And of course, there are a number of factors involved there, but you really zero in on a health factor.
Yeah, I think that by the time we get to this current iteration of the family, right, the most recent generation, you're seeing what you see in a lot of areas in the country, right? You're seeing some pretty unhealthy eating habits. You're seeing lots of obesity and lots of health problems that go along with that. And very different from the 150 years ago, you know, Choctaw guy who's running around and is incredibly lean because of what he's eating and how he's working. So my thought was that this farmer, Jake, that's the main character's name. He's based on a person. I mean, I didn't make all of this up. Like my friend calls it faction, right? It's like a mix of fact and fiction, this book. It's got a historical fiction bend, but a current fact bend also. And so this Jake character was based on somebody that I knew and that I met and that I had conversations with to kind of find out how he got to where he got. And, you know, his story is very similar to a lot of, I mean, other American story, but in particular, other farmers' stories of, you know, very long hours working, obviously, using pretty toxic chemicals and land management, and then not eating that well. And we're not talking about like this guy eating off the land that he is farming as his great, great grandfather or great, whatever, that generation in the past. He's not doing that. You know, he's of the generation kind of that I grew up in as well, maybe a little younger, where it's very fast food oriented. It's very quick fix oriented. It's eating things that, you know, say, obviously we don't have to go into this, but like the quality of the food these days, it's well documented, is a very different beast than it used to be. And so that is part of this book and how the chemical additives that we've used to keep away bugs and weeds and everything else that might hurt a yield are hurting the food also. And that's not news. I think that's kind of Everybody kind of knows that, but it's a very stark contrast. And that's one of the reasons, you know, I appreciate how you brought up how the book starts, because the contrast between where we are now and where we were then is drastic. And the best way that I could illustrate that is the health of those two individuals, the one at the beginning and the one right now. And so I think that without saying his name, Jake's, you know, real life doppelganger, as it were, he told me that this was very in line with his experience and how he grew up. And there's parts of this book that really were difficult for him to read. And he did try to commit suicide a couple times. And he's grateful now that he's here, but he's also very cognizant of what brought him here. And he's also kind of on a mission of trying to educate people about how we're eating, which is a bit more in the news these days, which is good, but also how that food's being grown and where it's coming from, right? Those are kind of the messages I wanted to get out there, like I said, without the reader really knowing it. And I don't know if you had that experience with the book, but that was my hope.
Yeah, well, we talk a lot about environmental impacts on this show. It is a special interest of mine. And you know, I've talked to people who've written books about glyphosate, which plays a central role in this book. Glyphosate, more commonly known as Roundup. Everywhere except the United States, it's been pretty well recognized that it has had profound health impacts, not only on the soil, but on people who use it as well. But before we get to that, let's go back to the ancestor ways. You talk about the three sisters right up in the beginning of the novel. Talk about the figure of the original patriarch, because he really appears throughout the book in some way.
Yeah, he does. He's a very gentle patriarch in the sense that I'm telling a story that's been told in other ways before in terms of Native American assimilation here and the attempt to sort of whitewash their history and their culture in order to integrate natives into American, so to speak, culture back, you know, in the late 1800s. And so he's this father that sees his wife die. And he sees his young child taken away to a school that my ancestors were at. It was a very well-known assimilation school in Oklahoma. And this character has so much loss, but he just keeps himself somehow grounded in the earth. And he keeps the faith, as it were. And eventually that son that gets sent off to school comes back. And that's the first kind of multi-generational look that we get, that father and son and their relationship, which, you know, and then it continues as the book goes along with the following generations. But that patriarch, when he dies and the son, you know, handles his burial, in a way he doesn't really die. Mm-hmm. And you can look at that metaphorically. You can look at it, you know, if you're into the paranormal thing, you can look at it however you want to, but that man's energy is still there. And it shows itself in different periods in the book when particularly egregious acts are happening with the land or with the people, or when things are out of balance, he appears. And he appears threatening to whoever's there because he has this message and he's angry, and it's the only way that he knows to try to communicate it. And so he was a very important part of this book from the start. I wanted to have that sort of, I don't know, Stephen King element where you had this sort of ghost character that you didn't know if it was real or if it was something these people were seeing, or like I said, if it was an energy or if it was what it was. And that's kind of what I like about a lot of what Stephen King does. You're not too sure what that character is. But in the book, you know, he appears as a kind of a horrific image that to whoever's seeing him. And it does drive, that's the last thing that Jake, the main character, sees as he's trying to commit suicide. He looks to his right, and he's trying to crash his truck into a tree, basically. And he sees that character. And that character shows up throughout until the very end, which I don't want to give away too much, but he takes a different shape, needless to say, at the end of the book.
Well, he's the embodiment in many ways of generational trauma, it seems.
Yes.
Yeah. And one interesting theme in the book is resistance to change, you know, resistance to knowledge, that different characters are confronted with, you know, things are not working, but they don't really want to get to the heart of the matter. There is one character that does, and that is the character of the doctor, Mark, who does that. So unspool that thread for us.
You know, it was, especially after talking to the guy that I based Jake on and doing a lot of research, I did not want to blame, for example, farmers for resisting, you know, as you said, the dangers of glyphosate or Roundup and or using Roundup ready seeds and that sort of thing. A lot of these guys and women were and are doing the best that they can with what they know and what they have. And they're trying to make a living. There's all sorts of other pressures they're under. It's farming here in the States is not, it's not an easy gig. And obviously it requires subsidies and it's very difficult. And especially if you're like a bigger family farm and, you know, you're trying to compete with industrial farms, it's very difficult. So a lot of these people are doing the best they can with what they know, right? And I wanted to make that clear as I wrote out these characters that, yes, they were resistant, but they were resistant because they were trying to stick with what they thought worked, even in the face of it not working, which we always do, you know, like all of us do that sometimes. The biggest, I guess, tragedy here, when it becomes your problem, is when you do know better, right? And there's a line in the book that says something to that effect. When I think that Mark is confronting Jake and is telling him, like, I've heard enough of the excuses because, you know, I'm showing you what's happening here and now you do know better. So there's no reason not to make a change, right? He gets a little frustrated with him. I think that not only in the book, but just in life in general, if you do know better and you're still following a certain path, then that's on you. But that's not always the case. And so I really wanted to be clear with that in the book. You know, I felt like I didn't want to be throwing farmers in general under the bus for like using these additives and the mechanical farming techniques just because I can. I think they're doing, for the most part, what they feel they have to do to get something out of this land, including like monocropping, right? And just growing soybeans or corn or whatever it might be. Like they're trying to do what the people before them have done in some ways. I talked to a few farmers that are generational and they were like, it's not that they weren't open to new ways of doing things, but they were kind of stuck in this rut of, well, this is how we've always done it. And if I shake it up, I'm going to spend 2 or 3 years losing money while I'm trying to, you know, incorporate a new technique of farming, and I can't afford to do that. So I highlighted that in the book too. I really wanted to put it out there that it's not really anybody's fault. And I am the first to try to, well, not blame people, but I'm the first to encourage accountability and responsibility. But in this case, it's a very complicated kind of metric. And so that's what I tried to write more simply about in the book in terms of story, right? That's the great thing about stories is that you can often take these complex ideas and wrap them into characters and into plots and make them make sense. That's what I was trying to do here.
Yeah, and I think you did it very well. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Alex Woodard about his novel, Ordinary Soil. Now, the health of the soil is very tied, I mean, as we've already implied, is very tied to the health of human beings. And in this case, the doctor comes in because Jake's health is so bad. He has already lost his daughter to leukemia. One of the points you make is not only that these traumas are intergenerational, both physical and emotional, but that they actually get worse generation after generation. Explain that.
This is something I was just thinking about again a couple days ago. The idea of the book was inspired by a podcast, which is a whole other story of how this even originated. But a friend of mine, Zach Bush, who did a podcast with a guy named Rich Roll, and they're both kind of in the wellness world. And I was very inspired by his message, which was kind of what I tried to communicate also in the book. Now, another thing Zach has talked about, he's a triple board certified MD who's taken, you know, a turn into more kind of the core causes of disease, and including, you know, soil health. And one of the things that fascinated me about his message was, we did this like a book release together up in Topanga Canyon here in California. And he started talking about epigenetics and how, and that's kind of the base of generational trauma in terms of these different kinds of traumas imprinting on genes that are passed along. And it can be environmental, it can be emotional, it can be physical, all sorts of different things. And from the outside, like, I could see a couple people there at this event kind of looking at each other going, what, epigenetics? What is this, right? And this is, like I said, 2023. And a friend of mine afterwards, who's a very conservative dear friend, was asking me, is like, do you think that's a real thing, this epigenetics? And she's like, she's in finance, she's an investment banker, she's like in that world. And I encouraged her to just Google it and, you know, see what's out there. And sure enough, the reason I'm telling the story is the next day, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about epigenetics. So of course, I forwarded it to her and said, well, here you go. And this idea of epigenetics was sort of foundational in my writing, because I think that obviously trauma passes from one generation to another in terms of, you know, abuse, for example, in the negative terms, in terms of abuse. That would be an easy way to see, well, his dad did it to him and his dad did it to him. And it just keeps, you know, moving down the chain. But there's something else happening there genetically that now is you can go and read all you want about it. It is a legit scientific area of study. Something else is going on too. And that comes down to how we're living and the environment, how we're treating it, what we're putting in our bodies, that sort of thing. That gets passed on generation to generation. And it, for lack of a better word, it builds up. And by the time you get to Jake at the end, that was my example there. Like, it's all built up into him. He's like the living embodiment of it, of this trauma over these generations, just kind of circling back on itself and getting more worse and worse and worse. And so the challenge for all of us is to, like, break that cycle. And that's where the book starts heading towards the end, is how do we break that? How do we break that cycle as individuals? How do we do it collectively? How do we do it for the planet? Those were all sort of themes that I was trying to point to as we got to the end. And I don't give exact answers to these things. I'm not suggesting that I know that there's a very clear solution, but I am suggesting that there's a way to change course if we want to.
Yes. And just for our audiences who may not know about epigenetics, epi means above. So genes can be switched on or off. And the idea of epigenetics is that trauma of one kind or another can switch certain genes that you've already inherited, but they can switch them on to cause disease. So let's talk about some of the solutions. I mean, one of the things, we didn't talk about the three sisters. I'm sure some of my audience know who the three sisters are, but why don't you tell us and what that whole concept means, not just beans, squash, and corn, but what does the concept of the three sisters embody as a way of approaching how we grow our food?
Yeah, the point is that the idea is that the three sisters help each other as they grow. You have corn, which comes out of the ground as a stalk, and near the corn stalks, you plant beans, which use the stalks as their trellises to grow. And then just outside the beans, you plant squash, and the huge leaves that are on those squash vines, they serve as protection for the soil and keep it protected from the sun. It keeps moisture in, and this becomes like this self-relegating system in a way, where each crop is helping the other. And it was extremely common in several native cultures. It was how they did it. And the fields, if you want to call it that, they don't look like what we think of as organized sort of agriculture, right? I mean, it is a mess. You're not planting corn in rows, right? You're planting it sort of in circles and mounds, and it's quite a different experience. But the idea is each crop helps the other, and it takes full advantage of each plant's tendencies, and it's quite ingenious. And so in areas where you could not get a lot of water, or where decent dirt was at a premium, in particular, in Native American culture, they would use this method because it was a very symbiotic kind of way of planting. And so that's a very strong theme through the book, because those three sisters get broken up and nobody's helping anybody anymore, right? And that's kind of the problem that we find ourselves in now.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with Alex Woodard about his novel, Ordinary Soil. Ordinary Soil is the name of this novel, and it links the soil microbiome with the gut microbiome. And just today, I was reading an article in either the Times or the Washington Post, I'm not sure which. It was in actually Science Magazine. It linked Alzheimer's to chronic inflammation in the gut microbiome. And yeah. Your doctor in the book links glyphosate with attacking the gut microbiome, basically making for a leaky gut, which is what right. does cause inflammation. So how do we nurture the gut microbiome and the soil microbiome by nurturing the kinds of relationships that you talk about with the three sisters?
You know, I think that this seems like a very big problem sometimes, and it seems like something that is sort of overwhelming in terms of solutions. But on an individual level, we can all be making a different set of decisions individually that will help ourselves, first of all. They're going to help your own gut, how you're eating and your choices in terms of what you consume is going to make a huge difference with your gut microbiome. And that means that you're going to farmers markets, or if that's not available to you, you are doing the best that you can at the store with buying, you know, non-GMO, like organic, even regenerative. There's a big push now towards regenerative agriculture, which has been happening for a while, but not in the big sense. Like I saw an ad on TV. It was like during a football game, I think, for Lundberg rice, and they were advertising it as regenerative. Yeah. That's a big deal. Like once that kind of awareness starts getting out there, it's a great, I mean, I was shocked and so happy to see it. So the point being that making these different kind of consumption decisions on the individual side can really help. I mean, it's everything, right? The simplified message of this book is that, you know, you get out what you put in, and that goes for the dirt, that goes for your stomach, that goes for your mind, that goes for your spirit, that goes for everything, right? Whatever you're consuming, it's going to come out. And I notice it with media, for example. Like, you know, if I'm consuming a certain kind of media for too long, my attitude changes, the way that I speak changes. I mean, you can't help but that happen. So that happens in all walks of life. So I think that paying particular attention and giving particular care to what you're taking in is a really good way to start repairing your microbiome and repairing maybe even these other parts of your life. It's overwhelming when you think about globally and trying to make these changes in the country and that kind of thing. But that's like turning a ship around in the ocean. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. It never has. You just have to make the change yourself. And then maybe a couple of your friends do. And then maybe somebody else a couple states over does. I mean, you know, it's a slow, slow process. And I feel like if it was like 3% or 2.5% of the consumption in the U.S. shifted towards organic, there would be this tipping point where farmers and producers would have more incentive to do that, right? I mean, you're seeing organic foods in Walmart of all places now. Like, that's a big deal. And that's because they know that they're going to make some money selling it. And then that's just kind of the way these things work, right? And so once there's a market for these kinds of foods, there's going to be producers rushing to fill it. And so your individual decision can really make an impact as it kind of collectively groups with other people making the same decisions. It's very powerful. I'm not a big fan of like getting out and spreading the word about how evil Monsanto is, or that's who was the originator of Roundup. It's now Bayer. I mean, there's already plenty of lawsuits and billions of dollars in settlements done there. That's not where my power lies, and that's not where your power lies. It's in, you know, our individual making better decisions individually and sharing those decisions.
Well, let's say maybe it's all of the above, because policy is also very important. In the farm bill, for example, there's plenty of subsidies for monoculture and for using Roundup and GMO, but there's not subsidies for farmers who are trying to do regenerative agriculture. So, you know, sometimes individual consumers can then get together and with their collective action to push government in the right direction.
That's very true. And that's very important. We're seeing it now. We're seeing how like different administrations can make very different decisions with this. And so you do need to have a voice. But I guess I was just speaking to somebody who might be listening to us right now and think, man, what can I do? I'm not going to go lobby. I'm not going to go do this or that or whatever. There is something you can do, right? And you can start making decisions on your own right now. But you're right, and it is going to take a village, and that is how things change. I mean, I think in Canada, you know, my in-laws are up in Canada, and they can't use glyphosate up there in agriculture, so they don't even know. They went to the store down here and just bought a bunch of cereal and stuff that was, you know, full of GMO. Like, it was probably not the best thing to be eating, but they didn't know. They were like, what? This is just what we get at home. And I said, what do you mean? And like, well, these Cheerios, this is the exact same thing we get. And I went and did a little research, and Canada's, you know, speaking, I'm saying this because of your comment about the policy, you know, you can't do it there. And it shows, you know, there's no availability on shelves for any of this stuff to be bought because you can't make it there. And so you're right. That's another big spoke in this wheel. But I do think that it gets a little overwhelming sometimes thinking about, well, what can I do as a person to change this? You know, there's nothing I can do, but there is. There's something you can do.
Well, in fiction or faction, as you called it, is a great way to help that to happen. Your novel is Ordinary Soil, Alex Woodard. And it's just been great to talk with you about it on this show. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you being open and checking the book out. I'm glad it resonated with you.
Alex Woodard is a singer-songwriter and author. You can find the audio version of Ordinary Soil, accompanied by the author's music, on Spotify. Next up, we revisit my conversation with Carrie Gillum about her book, The Monsanto Papers. Stay tuned after the break. This episode of Writer's Voice is sponsored by Larry's Coffee, exceptional coffee with a mission. Go to larryscoffee.com/voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. After listening to our conversation with Alex Woodard, I thought it would be apt to revisit our conversation with Carrie Gillum about her page-turning follow-up to a previous book, Whitewash. It's called The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. Glyphosate, commonly known as Roundup, is the world's most widely used herbicide. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, or IARC, says it's a probable human carcinogen. Other scientific studies have linked it not only to cancer, but to kidney and liver damage, endocrine disruption, reproductive harm and birth defects, neurological damage, and immune system dysfunction. It doesn't just poison people, but the insects that pollinate our food crops and other living beings. But aggressive public relations by glyphosate's developer, Monsanto, and its current purveyor, Bayer, has resulted in the widespread perception that glyphosate is safe. So it's no surprise that school groundskeeper Lee Johnson thought Roundup was safe. But two tragic accidental spills of the chemical left him with a horribly disfiguring and deadly disease. In a groundbreaking case with global implications, Johnson took Monsanto to court and won. We last spoke with journalist Carrie Gillum about her expose of how Monsanto had captured federal agencies and academic scientists to promote glyphosate and suppress attempts to regulate it. Now she's come out with the thrilling courtroom drama of Lee Johnson's suit against Monsanto. It's called the Monsanto Papers. Carrie Gillum, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
We last spoke with you, I believe it was in 2017, about your book, Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. And congratulations, it won the 2018 Rachel Carson Book Award. That's terrific.
Thank you. Yeah, that meant a lot to me.
So this book, The Monsanto Papers, is a follow-up to that story. It's a kind of true crime story, corporate crime, and courtroom drama. You tell it thrillingly. It tells the inside story of a man named Lee Johnson, his 2018 lawsuit and trial against Monsanto. But before we get to the story of Mr. Johnson and his case, I'd like to talk a little bit about Monsanto itself. And, you know, what I was surprised, I think I probably knew this, but I hadn't put it together the way you did in this book. Monsanto's responsible not just for the toxic substance glyphosate, which is in Roundup, but it's produced the all-star lineup of deadly chemicals, PCB, DDT, Agent Orange. I'd just like to ask you, what is the business model that makes Monsanto, or made it, the killer company that it is, and that's not a metaphor.
Well, of course, Monsanto is not alone, you know, in peddling products and substances and chemicals that we now understand are, you know, so dangerous and have done so much damage to the environment, to human health. You know, this was sort of what we saw in the rise of industrialization and these industrial chemicals, and then a turn to using these chemicals more in agriculture. You know, all of this transpired over the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And of course, Rachel Carson wrote in her book, Silent Spring, and other works about the dangers of the rise of the use of very dangerous chemicals in our world, and what that would mean for health, not only for birds and insect species, but for us people, you know, and she was right. And sadly, you know, I think the lessons that we learned or should have learned from Rachel Carson, you know, we seem to have forgotten those, because we are in a new age of seemingly pushing more and more pesticides, particularly into agriculture and food production.
Yes, and it's really terrifying. So now, tell us a little bit about glyphosate itself, what it does to the human body generally, because what it did to Mr. Lee Johnson was really, really shocking. And I'll ask you about that in a little bit later. But tell us the impact of glyphosate. What are we learning about it?
So glyphosate, Monsanto introduced glyphosate and patented this as a weed-killing chemical in 1974. And Monsanto has always maintained that it's much safer than other weed-killing chemicals that are on the market or have been on the market for many, many years. And they were able to really, multiply the use of this chemical when they introduced genetically engineered crops in the 1990s that were altered, had their DNA altered so that they could withstand being sprayed with glyphosate weed killing chemicals. And the weeds in the field would die, but then the crops would not. It was the way that this system worked, or does still work. And that really just profoundly increased the use of glyphosate chemicals. In the 90s, for example, there was about 124 million pounds of glyphosate being used around the world. That figure is now close to 2 billion pounds a year. And so this is the most widely used weed killer in the world. It's ubiquitous. It's found in rain and air samples and soil and water. It's in the food that we eat. And it's found very commonly in human urine samples. If you have your urine tested for this chemical, you'll find weed killer in your own body. Monsanto was very successful in pushing this to just extraordinary levels of use.
And, you know, part of the business model that does this is regulatory capture. In your last book, you spoke about that in more detail, you know, how the EPA had been captured, and it's only gotten worse. What did get worse under Trump? If it could get worse, I hope it will get better. So where has that left those people who have been so severely affected by glyphosate?
Yeah, so over the years, as glyphosate rose to prominence as such a widely used chemical, more and more scientists started looking at the human and environmental impacts. And that's where we saw this development of research showing that indeed it could be cancer-causing and cause non-Hodgkin lymphoma and an array of other health problems in people, and then many, many different environmental harms as well. So, you know, regulators, sadly, in Europe and the U.S. and many other countries have not really recognized the evidence of cancer and health problems. They have sort of stuck to the Monsanto narrative that, you know, this doesn't cause cancer. We don't need to worry about it. They rely pretty heavily on science that was generated by Monsanto and other companies that sell glyphosate products. So there is no official cancer warning on any of these products, though the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is part of the World Health Organization, has classified it officially as a probable human carcinogen with a tie to non-Hodgkin lymphoma specifically.
And has any substance that's been so classified as a probable human carcinogen ever be found to be completely benign?
Oh, not that I am familiar with, no. These are the expert cancer scientists, some of the most prominent and well-respected scientists in the world who made this determination. And they looked at years of epidemiology and toxicology and genotoxicity. And, you know, in fact, what we're seeing is more evidence of cancer causation, not less, as the research continues to develop.
Right. And now tell us about Mr. Lee Johnson. It turned into a landmark case, but it's a shocking case. Tell us about him and what happened to him.
Yeah, I really wanted to tell this story. My first book was very scientific, nerdy, maybe very, academic. And this book, I wanted it to really just resonate with everybody, with the general readers. Just I wanted it to be the truly dramatic story that it was, you know, as I watched this case unfold. And I wanted people to feel like they knew this very special man, Lee Johnson, who was the very first person in the world to end up taking Monsanto to court, to trial. Lee's a, average guy, pulled himself up by the bootstraps, had a hard childhood, didn't really know his dad, didn't graduate college, really struggled, but got himself together kind of in middle age, was married, two little boys of his own, working a good job as a school groundskeeper, spraying chemicals, glyphosate-based Roundup, another Ranger Pro, another herbicides around schools, and really trying to do his job well and make sure that he was there to be a really good role model and influence for his kids. And then he experiences in the book, you follow him to work and you are with him on the day that he suffers this really tragic accident in which there's a malfunction with the tank sprayer of the weed killer. And he gets just doused, you know, head to toe and soaked in this pesticide. And then, you know, over the months and that follow that, you know, he develops a lesion and then more and then more. And then ultimately he's diagnosed with terminal non-Hodgkin lymphoma and, you know, told essentially he's not going to be there for his boys. He's not going to see them grow up.
And when you say a lesion, what describe that? What do you mean?
Oh, Lord. I mean, some of them look like if someone put a cigar out on your body, you know, just round, deep holes. I mean, just wounds that weep and bleed and ooze and sometimes get infected, eruptions, and then they scar over. You know, I mean, it's horrific to actually look at the devastation. This is a type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma that manifests in the skin. There are many different types of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. This is mycosis fungoides, which affects the tissues, the skin tissue. And it looks like I think I described in the book, like he's been burned in a war, you know, that he never signed up to fight. Like he just, at one point looking at the wounds on his body when I was interviewing him, you know, I had to cry. I couldn't bear that someone was suffering the way that he has suffered.
And he was really disfigured.
Very, yeah. It's just profoundly sad and tragic what he's been going through.
He's a remarkable person, and he was a careful person. I mean, he was careful about health and safety, unlike a whole lot of other people. You know, he took precautions, but as you said, this was an accident, and it wasn't the only one.
Right. He, after the first accident and he, you know, starts to get these lesions and he's seen a doctor and he's trying to be treated and they think that maybe it's the type of a skin cancer. They're not, you know, he calls Monsanto, actually. He's been doing some research and sees that there's some concern about glyphosate and cancer and calls Monsanto and gets to talk to somebody there and expresses his concern, says he's, you know, really wants to know if this could be causing cancer, because if it is, he wants to stop doing his job. He should stop spraying this chemical. He doesn't want to make it worse. But they don't call him back. And we see in internal emails that I show in the book, you know, that Monsanto talked about his situation and they talked about his call internally. But they elected not to call him back, not to warn him, not to give him any information. And he just kept spraying until another accident pushed him over the edge and pushed him into a terminal situation.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist and author Carrie Gillum about her book, The Monsanto Papers. It's a follow-up from her first book, Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. And this one follows a story of Lee Johnson, a landmark case that was brought against Monsanto for the damages that the weed killer glyphosate had visited upon Mr. Johnson, devastating ones with a fatal disease. Now, he does find a lawyer. Actually, you follow other characters in the book, like the attorneys. For example, Mike Miller, the lead attorney on this, he went into action, in fact, when the IARC found glyphosate to be a probable human carcinogen, as we spoke about before. Tell us a little bit about Mike Miller and how, you know, how did they get in touch with each other?
Sure. So, yeah, Mike Miller is the patriarch, the founder of a law firm in Virginia, in a little teeny tiny town called Orange, Virginia. And he is, you know, just quite a character. He's a good old Southern gentleman, and he's tried lots of very, very big cases, never against a chemical company, an agrochemical company like Monsanto. Always really he specialized in sort of pharmaceutical and medical device work and that sort of thing. But, you know, very good at what he did in terms of bringing cases against very powerful companies that injured people. So after this cancer decision, classification by this international scientific body, he started doing research and filed initial litigation against Monsanto so that he could start discovery, which is the process of getting court-ordered documents from inside the company. And Monsanto, you know, wasn't too fearful. You're there in the book, you're there in that meeting where he first sat down with Monsanto's lawyers, and they said, sure, we'll give you whatever you want. We don't have anything to hide. Don't worry about it. And they ultimately turn over about, you know, a little more than 10 million documents that Mike Miller's firm gets to go through. And so you go through that process and are with them as they are sitting in this little law firm in Virginia, pulling these documents and finding what they term as gold, pure gold. And they know they've got a good case. And then they're advertising and Lee Johnson finds them because they're advertising for clients, people who have been hurt or injured by their use of Roundup or glyphosate products.
So what made it such a good case? And do you have any idea, was Monsanto just unaware of what they were giving or was it just the arrogance of power?
You know, if you talk to the lawyers, and the story, again, is very much told through Lee Johnson's eyes and then the eyes of this team of lawyers, they thought it was hubris, just sheer arrogance, that is what they will tell you, is what they've told me, that these lawyers and this company had always won the day, had always gotten away with, you know, whatever they needed to do to keep this product rolling, and were usually quite successful in court in terms of any sort of challenges to them on any of their products. So the takeaway from the lawyers was just that they didn't think they could be beaten.
And so what made it such a good case?
Oh, my Lord. Well, again, there's so many dramatic twists and turns. So from that standpoint, as I was watching this case and reporting on it and traveling around the country and sort of following the lawyers and getting to know Lee's family and Lee's situation, there were lots of things that happened. You know, there's a tragic accident just on the eve of trial. Another lawyer gets, in a lot of trouble. Someone Lee was pretty close to and goes down a dark path. There are divorces. There's financial stress. So there's a lot of dramatic elements to it that I think make it a really good story. And of course, it reveals through these documents that these lawyers find and the evidence that they present, there are a lot of revelations that are important for public policy and just, you know, public understanding of how corporations like Monsanto can manipulate science, can manipulate regulators, can deceive consumers, and really push these harmful products into the marketplace where they're used for decades. So I think it's also emblematic and sort of a warning tale of what happens in many other sort of industries and sectors of our society.
Could you just give us a couple of examples of what you mean by that? You know, the ways that they operate to manipulate, say, the regulators, you know, which they certainly did in this case.
Yeah. So one of the things that we found out, and part of the drama of the whole story, is how these lawyers were able to bring these documents that they got through discovery into public light so that we could all see them and learn about them. Because Monsanto, of course, once they turned them over and realized, oh my goodness, we've revealed a lot of secrets here, they tried to keep them sealed. And how those documents became unsealed and thrust into the public light just past midnight one summer evening, you know, is sort of dramatic in and of itself. But we learned, for instance, that an arm of the Health and Human Services Department wanted to take an independent look at this chemical in 2015, about the same time these international cancer scientists were doing that. And they wanted to look at the toxicity and cancer questions, and Monsanto didn't want them to do that. And they were very worried about it. And they talk internally about the concern that they have about this agency looking hard at the science around their chemical. So they enlist the help of EPA officials to quash this investigation by this other agency. And to see the conversations and the text messages and the emails that go back and forth, and you see EPA officials jumping to help them, rushing, saying, yeah, we're on it. And one official saying, you know, I'll do my best. If I can kill this, I should get a medal. Because it's going to be really hard to get this other agency not to do this work. And you see all that unfold. And there's just example after example after example of that sort of behind the scenes manipulation that goes on. That's just outrageous.
And was this during a Republican administration or a Democratic one?
Well, I have to say, the manipulations have gone on throughout, you know, for decades now. I mean, we have problems in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2000s. So this would have been 2015. So where were we? We were still with Obama then, weren't we? Yeah. So
it's a bipartisan regulatory capture.
It definitely is. Yes.
So now Johnson won his case, but he's still waiting for justice. Tell us what's going on, what's happening, and what does that say about the courts being the remedy for justice for people who are victims of these companies?
Well, actually, Lee did finally get paid just right after my book went to print. So if we get a reprint here, we'll have to update that. But the company appealed. He did win. He won $289 million from a jury that was outraged at the deception and the weight of the scientific evidence, and then the weight of the deception, the evidence of deception and manipulation. $289 million. Appellate judges reduced that pretty significantly. Monsanto kept appealing. There's a provision in California that is sort of odd, but if someone is expected to die very soon, they are not usually entitled to as much money in a lawsuit payout, because they're not expected to be suffering for long. They're not expected to have, you know, medical bills that continue. So because he had a very short life expectancy, his amount of money that he was awarded was cut very dramatically through the appeals process. So his ultimate went from $289 to $20.5 million. And after losing all of their appeals, Monsanto finally paid him in last fall.
It's really terrible. I mean, if somebody dies early, that leaves his family bereft for longer.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, yes, if he had been expected to live another 20 years, you know, the award would have been allowed to be higher, perhaps. But because of his short life expectancy, we should note, though, that Lee Johnson has outlived what the doctors have said. His own doctors told him he had 18 months to live. Monsanto's doctors argued that he had maybe 24. And, you know, it's been past that now, and he's still out there living and hanging on. And he's, you know, kind of goes up and down. And some days he feels all right, and other days he just feels terrible, but he's hanging in there.
Yes, a very brave soul also. Tell us a little bit about your personal experience of him.
Getting to know Lee was really, I feel like it's the perfect example of, you know, peeling back the layers on an onion, I guess, or whatever that phrase is. If you know, he's hard to get to know, I think, at the beginning. He's got some walls up around him. He's had a really hard time and, you know, been in the spotlight, which is not something that he necessarily relished. He treasures his privacy. He treasured his health. He treasures his boys, you know, his family. And it's really been very emotionally, you know, just hard for him, as well as physically, you know, hard. But once you get inside and you get him to trust you and talk to you, he's just such an incredible and lovely individual, and very creative. He's artistic. He makes music. He paints. He draws. He writes. And he has some really, you know, profound views about the world and, you know, how we should all care for each other and do well as best we can and raise our children right. And, you know, he's a special person. And I feel honored that I have been able to spend, you know, quite a bit of time with him.
And now, what is the significance of this win? You know, is it changing anything? In fact, Monsanto was bought by Bayer. So what's happening going forward here in terms of the deployment of this chemical and redress for people who've been injured by it?
So it is true, Bayer, the giant pharmaceutical company based in Germany, bought Monsanto in June of 2018, just as the Lee Johnson trial was beginning, which was incredibly bad timing on their part. They paid about $63 billion for Monsanto. And by August of that year, when the jury verdict came down in favor of Johnson, their market capitalization plunged about 40%. Investors became outraged, and two subsequent trials that they also lost just put investors up in arms. They are furious still to this day that this company spent all this money on Monsanto. They are now trying to settle the litigation. There's about 100,000 plaintiffs, likely Johnson, who've sued in the U.S., and the Bayer has said it will pay $11 billion to settle as many of those as it can. They're trying to put out another $2 billion or so to head off future litigation and pay people who've been exposed but maybe haven't sued yet. And they're just really struggling to try to figure out how to get out from under this huge weight of this litigation. At the same time, there's class action in Australia that is going forward, and Mexico is looking to ban glyphosate. Thailand tried to ban glyphosate. France, Italy, Germany, other countries are looking to ban it now. New York State is moving to ban it. You know, it's been a very impactful litigation, and Lee Johnson's case was, you know, what got it all rolling, really.
Well, that's great. Now you are the research director. You used to work for Reuters, but you're the research director for a nonprofit organization called U.S. Right to Know. Tell us about that organization and its link to your journalism.
So I spent, you know, 17 years at Reuters, which is this big international news agency, and that's where I covered agriculture and Monsanto and got to really, you know, learn all that has informed my books and my work. Joined U.S. Right to Know in 2016. It's a little tiny nonprofit, and really all we do is investigative research or investigative journalism, I guess you would say. We file Freedom of Information Act requests with federal agencies and state record requests with universities and state agencies, and just are in the business of trying to gather documents and data that pertain to public and environmental health, you know, on pesticides and other health-related issues, and then share that information with other journalists or lawyers or lawmakers or consumers, policymakers, just trying to be a one-stop shop for people who don't have the time and resources and tenacity to fight for, you know, government documents that are important. You know, I've had to sue the EPA twice. I've sued the FDA once to get documents that they should turn over. You know, that I think these agencies forget they're public agencies. They're supposed to work for, you know, the public good, and they need to be reminded of that. And so that's what we do at U.S. Right to Know.
Do you have any opinion on the new heads of EPA and FDA? Do you think that things might get better going forward?
You know, I'm cynical, but I don't want to be. So I think Biden's administration is talking a good game right now so far. You know, they're saying they want to restore scientific integrity. They want to relook at sort of decisions and positions on chemicals like glyphosate and other pesticides and other chemical substances where the science is showing us we really should be reining them in. The Trump administration sort of opened the barn door and just said, here you go, chemical companies, whatever you want, you got. Biden's administration has said that they're going to try to, you know, get a handle on things again. So I don't know. I'm skeptical, cynical, but I have hope.
Well, that's great. And people who read your book, The Monsanto Papers, Carrie Gillam, can get informed so that they may be able to add their voices to making sure the EPA and the FDA protect the American public.
Exactly. And that's what it's all about.
Carrie Gillam, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. The book is The Monsanto Papers. And you can go to writersvoice.net to read more about glyphosate's devastating impacts on human health and on the environment. This episode of Writer's Voice is sponsored by Larry's Coffee, exceptional coffee with a mission. Go to larryscoffee.com/voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.